Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend. Three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC. Have you heard yet about this new citywide program which hopes to get New Yorkers on the same page? Literally, one book, one New York aims to get New Yorkers to read the same book at the same time and hold discussions about the book all over the city. It will be the biggest community read in the country ever if they pull it off. And the first step is to vote on one of five books. Here they are: Americana, by Chimamanda and Ngozi Adichie. She's going to come on later this week. She was here for a book interview when Americana came out, and she's going to come back. Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. The Sellout by Paul Beatty. A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, that old classic, by Betty Smith. And The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao by Juno Diaz. And joining us now to talk about this exciting new campaign and maybe to make a case for his book, are Julie Menon, the commissioner of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment, which is spearheading the initiative, and Juno Diaz, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Oscar Wao and professor of writing at MIT. Commissioner, welcome back. Juno, always an honor. Welcome back to WNYC.
No, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Julie Menon, you want to set this out for everybody? What's a community read?
Absolutely, Brian. First of all, thanks for having me. So we are thrilled to be spearheading this initiative, One Book, One New York. Many other cities have done a One Book initiative, but we put a different spin on it. We had a committee that recommended a number of different books. We have five books in total. We paired a celebrity with each book, and we partnered with BuzzFeed, who made a video of each celebrity promoting that book, and then we've put it out to a public vote, where in the month of February, New Yorkers can vote on which of the five books they want New York to read. And it's really spurring just a tremendous response with thousands of people voting each and every day. And one of the reasons, Brian, that we're really excited about this program, of course, for the literacy efforts, but it's also an effort to really support the independent bookstores in New York, which we know are struggling.
Juno, what's your role here? Are you here to, like, make a case for Oscar Wao, or what do you want to do?
Well, this certainly isn't, in my point of view, I wasn't excited to join this for strictly personal reasons. Of course, one always, one is always gratified to be selected for, an opportunity like this. But the reality is this, for me, is about book culture and about our literary culture. These very fragile institutions, these are very fragile cultural spaces. The opportunity to promote reading, the opportunity to promote literature, to promote thinking about books, thinking about literacy, this is invaluable. And we're in a time where I think we've become aware that our civic imaginaries are under threat and that we often don't have enough common experiences where we can sort of, wrestle with. We don't have common terms. And I think books are excellent ways to bring folks together in conversation.
Julie Menon, some of the history of this, I think Chicago really set the template like 15 years ago when they did a citywide read on To Kill a Mockingbird, and then some other cities started trying it. Is that your seminal inspiration?
Well, that's exactly right. Actually, back in February when the mayor appointed me as Commissioner of Media and Entertainment, I was at an event with the author Tom Wolfe, and he was speaking to me exactly about Chicago's program and the reading of To Kill a Mockingbird, and that really sparked an interest in me to do a program like this. Interestingly, we went back and looked to see any origins in New York City. In 2002, a number of literary and civic groups got together to try to pull off a one-book program, but in an only in New York moment, the committee actually could not agree on the book, and so it did not happen. And so that was a cautionary tale, and we did not want to have that here, and that's why we had a really august, terrific committee recommend a number of different books, and that's when we decided that we wanted to have five books and put it out to a public vote. And just as Juno's saying, this idea of a civic discourse is an incredibly important motivation here, because all five of these books deal with important issues of immigration, of race and ethnic identity in America, of the issue of being an outsider. And so it's very important in this political climate to be having these types of discussions, and we certainly hope that this program will spur those civic dialogues.
Do you want to talk more, maybe elaborate on that point, Juno, about what some of these books have in common that makes them sort of the right list for now, whichever one winds up prevailing?
Well, you can just sort of move down the list. And one of the, I mean, I think if this disparate constellation of wonderful texts has commonalities, is this robust spirit of inquiry, this robust spirit of dialogue. These are books that aren't proposing answers, I don't think, but raising all sorts of questions and asking people to engage in the kinds of sympathies and the kinds of sort of connectivities, which we're often not encouraged to do so. I think that a lot of us forget that when you're in a quote-unquote a nation, you're in this incredibly large family, and that it's not easy to simplify a family just by talking about one individual. Let's say you belong to a family and one of your members is a werewolf. Well, if you focus on the werewolf, you forget that a large part of the family ain't got werewolves. If you focus on the other family, you forget you got a werewolf in the family. And I think it's important to sort of remember that even at the level of family, our diversity is stupendous. And I think all of these books, from my point of view, the books just have a sensibility that simplification and that generalizations, that these are things that all of us wrestle with to try to achieve a kind of a truer vision of the world. These are books where all of the characters are struggling to find a home, struggling to find connection, struggling to find a community, and struggling to find a voice against all sorts of pressures that try to silence them and try to, you know, offer them much more simplistic varieties of the world that they know themselves deep down is far too complicated for such formulas.
Listeners, do you want to call in and talk to Juno Diaz, who's here representing his particular book, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, one of the five nominees for the One Book, One New York program, where if this works out, the whole city will be reading one of five books and having discussions about the issues and ideas and writing from within those books. And Julie Menon, who is the commissioner of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment, which is spearheading the initiative, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Anything you always wanted to ask Juno Diaz about Oscar Wilde, if you read the book, or anything else? And it looks like Diane in Harlem is calling in to do a little electioneering. Hi, Diane. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian, and hi, Mr. Diaz. I cannot tell you how thrilled I am to pose this question to you, because my two daughters, Jessica and Whitney, have read all of your books. They love all of your books, and they are quite annoyed with me that I never finished Oscar Wilde. So I'm voting for your book because I would like to get a little kick to complete the book. And I was just wondering, are you going to engage with the reader during the course of the reading or after the reading is over by way of a little assignment or writing prompts or anything along those lines?
Yeah, I think all of us who are sort of in the position to do so are going to be engaging the audience. I think part of this effort is, for us, it's, again, it's less sort of campaigning for our books and more sort of being ambassadors for book culture and the living literary culture, that writers are out there, that books are out there, that there's relationships between readers, books, and writers. So I'll definitely be around. Whether anyone wants to say anything to me or not, that's different, but I'll be around. And I'm, all my fellows, writers who can be, will also be around.
Commissioner, maybe you can flesh out a little more of how this will actually work once a book is selected. What will the role of the authors be? What kinds of public forums will there be? How are you going to engage the city to get as many people to read whichever book as possible?
Absolutely, Brian. So first of all, we're going to reveal the winning book in the beginning of March. Whichever book wins, we are having a discussion with the author in the at the New York Public Library, which will be open to all in June, and we'll be doing events throughout the spring and the summer focusing on that particular book. And one of the really interesting things is other cities such as Chicago that have done one-book programs, or Seattle or Philadelphia, have seen enormous spikes in book sales of that particular book. And the only reason I mention that is I mentioned earlier about independent bookstores. Right now we have about 65 independent bookstores citywide, but the Bronx has no bookstore. They used to have a Barnes & Noble. It closed. Staten Island has one independent bookstore. So we're really, these bookstores are under threat of closure, and one important economic reason why we want to do this program is to really celebrate the independent bookstore and make sure that people visit their local bookstore. In addition, right now we have 4,000 copies of these five books in the 219 public library branches. So for all of your listeners, also please visit your public library branch and you can check out one of these five books.
So really people should go to the library branch and put all five books on hold right now and then see which one wins so it comes in on time, right?
Exactly.
Arnold in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hi, Arnold.
Hi, which of the five books is designed for the Trump supporter?
Aha. Uh-huh. Go ahead, Juno.
Yeah, again, I've always thought that books have to contain enough in them to engage anyone. The idea that books necessarily are, they're sort of partisan creatures is wild, because I travel around for the books. I was in Iowa. I was in Michigan just in the last couple of weeks. And what's extraordinary is how literature and art just crosses political lines. If one is looking for a book that is going to be a narrative of consolation or to confirm their political orthodoxies, you're not going to find it in any real literature. In fact, most books are here to wheedle the hell out of us and to sort of upset us and get us outside of our kind of political and sort of, our sense of the world, our kind of formulas. And what was interesting for me was being both in Michigan and being in Iowa, basically back to back, and having all these folks coming up to me who are like, yeah, man, I read your book. I really like your book. I voted for Trump, FYI. And that's, that reminds us of the kind of complexity and the ways that folks create relationships to art that sometimes outstrips even their politics.
He might have been reacting to what you said before. It ties all these books together. And I can't recreate your exact words, but the idea that it would, get people to identify more with the other people outside of themselves, that kind of thing, which might strike some Trump supporters as sort of an anti-Trump nationalist project that the city is undertaking, choosing books that, that represent diversity.
Well, Brian, can I interject here on something? So one of the interesting elements of this is these five books were selected right before the election because we were working with BuzzFeed. We made the videos of each celebrity, and those took some time to record. Interestingly, all five of these books, however, do have the, as Juno was saying, sort of a commonality of theme. And so we think that it's rather prescient to be reading these books during this political climate. And no matter what one's political persuasion is, there are such important lessons to be learned in each of these five books.
Rebecca in Yonkers, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
Hello.
Oh, hello.
So you're an English teacher, I see.
Yes,
and
I'm an English teacher.
You teach some of Juno Diaz's work?
I haven't begun to yet, but I first picked up a Juno Diaz book when I was around 20 years old. I was still an undergrad at NYU, and I've been a fan ever since. And even before I heard this event was going on, I loved Juno Diaz's book, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. It's been one of my favorites ever. So I just wanted to
tell people, tell people why. How come? Why that book?
It's just a really beautifully crafted. It's so nuanced with there's just so much. It's just rich in history and culture and comedy and drama, and it's probably one of the only books that I've read that's made me laugh, cry, fear. I felt so many emotions while reading that book. It's an amazing work of literature. I mean, I don't know if my students would be ready for of literature of that caliber, but mm-hmm. I mean, I definitely like to incorporate it into my classroom since I do teach a lot of students who either are immigrants or are sons and daughters of immigrants, mm-hmm. many of whom migrated from the Dominican Republic. So I feel like they have certain similar experiences. Mm-hmm. And me being the daughter of an immigrant, I am Latin American, so I feel like I have that sort of same, vein running through me. Mm-hmm. Just, I guess, which is why I was able to relate to his literature. A lot of his protagonists were of also Latin American descent, and just kind of bringing the best of both worlds and both experiences. It's just amazing. I'm just really excited that this is happening.
Rebecca,
rooting for him.
thank you so much. And I'm going to pivot right to another high school teacher who has taught Oscar Wilde for years, he says. Peter in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Oh, greetings, Brian, and hello, Juno. I've Hi. Been teaching it for several years, and the thing that really stands out more than any other thing is just the level of engagements that the students get from this text. And I think when you give reading assignments to kids and many people in the class are way ahead in the reading or finish the book, like within a week, you know you have something really worthwhile. And the other thing is that it's about the diaspora, the Dominican diaspora, and many of my students are Dominican. So it's been a really good way for them to talk to their parents about Trujillo and many of the political events that went on in the Dominican Republic in years past. And it got this sort of intergenerational dialogue going where kids would come in and say what their parents or what their grandparents told them about Trujillo.
Thank you very much. All right. We'll do one more along those lines. George in Huntington wants to ask, I think, a particular question of Juno about the book. Yes, George?
Yeah, thank you. I had a pleasure of leading a book discussion group at the World Women's Birthplace, and your book was one of them in that group, so through the New York State Council of the Humanities. To follow up on what the previous caller said and what Julie mentioned, the portrayal of Trujillo's regime and the political culture of corruption and violence in your book as that you represent, how do you see that as being important for people in today's political climate and the, you know, Trump administration and what some people fear about it.
Juno?
Well, first, everyone, thank you so much. Everyone's so very kind to even read the book and organize and to teach around it. There is no democracy which is not perpetually imperiled by corrupt, power-hungry, deceptive lunatics. The one thing about democracy is that it is both fragile and incredibly powerful. And I think it's just something we all know and sense, or at least we should all know and sense, that this is the most valuable resource we have. And I grew up in a country that was perverted by dictatorial regimes. Even in our post-dictatorial democracy, you had folks who ran these pseudo-democracies that were, in fact, more dictatorial than they were democratic and egalitarian. I think that anyone who believes that power and bullying and xenophobia and granting power to our political leaders and undermining our democratic institutions like journalism, anyone who thinks that's a good idea, I think they haven't spent any time anywhere near a dictatorship, or they've been dreaming of a dictatorship themselves, one that they wish to benefit from. I think it's a terribly, terribly frightening thing to live in a society where a small coterie of people have an enormous amount of power, where the majority of people live in fear and silence and have to swallow the deceptive fantasies being produced by the regimes. I came out of this tradition. It disfigures the heart, it disfigures the tongue, it disfigures the mind, and ultimately disfigures the society. And I think for those of us who are living through this moment in the United States, there's a real reason that we should be alarmed by our current president and our current regimes. And why, again, I turn to the consolations, the encouragement, and the courage which literature and the art provide us.
And with time running out on the segment, we have gotten to the heart of the matter with Juno Diaz, author of The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao, among other books. And again, listeners, just to sum up, he's the first guest, along with Commissioner Julie Menon, in the series that we'll do related to the books that are in this competition. And again, it is a project by the city called One Book, One New York, which is aiming to get New Yorkers to read the same book at the same time. There are five books that have been nominated: The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao by Juno Diaz, Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She'll be here later in the week, we know. We've invited the other living authors, too: Ta-Nehisi Coates, who wrote Between the World and Me, and Paul Beatty, who wrote The Sellout. And the fifth book is A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, that old classic by Betty Smith. And Commissioner Menon, just tell everybody one more time exactly how they can vote for which book the whole city will then endeavor to read.
They can go online and vote at www.nyc.gov/onebook. So you can vote on your phone, and we really encourage all New Yorkers to please log on and vote for the book that they want New York City to read.
All right. And once there's a book, Commissioner, we look forward to being a part of the conversation and figuring out how we can contribute to having meaningful discussions like we just had a little of, whether it wins or not, about the ideas in Oscar Wao.
So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And Juno Diaz, great to have you on the show again.
No, thank you.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Did you see the article in the New York Times Magazine this weekend by historian Alexis Coe? She finds reassurance about the future on this fraught President's Day by looking to the ghost of presidents past, more specifically to biographies of presidents past. The recurring lesson: at any given time, half the country thinks they're living through the end of the American experiment. Ha! Alexis Coe joins us now. She is host of the podcast Presidents Are People Too, author of the book Alice and Frida Forever, and she is writing a biography of George Washington. Alexis, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC, and happy President's Day, if it is a happy President's Day.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your article begins with the story of the unlikely rise to the presidency of a deeply unpopular and untrustworthy New Yorker whose administration would surely be defined by unprecedented greed and woefully unqualified appointees lacking any experience in government.
Far-fetched story.
Very, very far-fetched story. Who's it about?
Yeah, Chester A. Arthur. He was our 21st president, and no one elected him to the office. He ascended there after Garfield was assassinated by a disgruntled office seeker. And he had been fired by another president, Rutherford B. Hayes. As an example, Arthur was a part of this New York machine. And so he was Roscoe Conkling's like right-hand man. He was in charge of the port. So, you know, just a poster child for the spoil system.
I did not know that piece of history. Chester Allen Arthur, before becoming president, worked for President Hayes.
And he was fired immediately as to reform, the civil service reform. And so,
so there's hope for Michael Flynn to be president of the United States someday, is what you're telling me.
No. 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 I hope that is definitely not what I'm telling you.
But seriously.
But it, so he's fired, but you still have to keep those New Yorkers happy. And so Garfield picks him as his vice president. Certain factions are unhappy, but think, what are the chances? But in fact, they seem quite good. And so he ascends to the presidency, and the unthinkable happens. He doesn't he reforms civil service. He becomes this poster child of what the office can inspire in its inhabitants. And it was a truly moving story for me, as are honestly almost all of the presidential history.
Now, actually, Flynn has been fired by two presidents. He got fired by Obama, and now he got fired by Trump. Has that ever happened before in American history? I don't expect you to know every piece of presidential history.
Oh, I'm sure it has. I'm sure it has.
It's hard to get fired by two presidents who hate each other. So one of the points of your article, in a way, is that presidents who we think are going to destroy the fabric of democracy sometimes turn out to be okay.
Sometimes. They sometimes turn out to be okay. What I do understand about American history is that at any given moment, half the population thinks that it's the downfall of America, that it's the end of the American experiment. And what happens is, even if it's a particularly disastrous presidency, there is a period of recovery. Now, that doesn't mean that lives are not damaged, both American citizens and sometimes entire countries. The globe can be destabilized by American democracy if handled indelicately. But we do have this long history in which we have survived, and that gives me great comfort, far more than scrolling through Twitter or reading the news.
And so you write about carrying the biography of Chester Allen Arthur by Zachary Carabel around with you for weeks at a time like a security blanket.
I do. Now, I have to say that that's from the American President series, the Schlesinger series, and those are very nice to carry around because they come in at like a little bit under 200 pages. It's not like a Ron Chernow 900-page break-your-back sort of thing. And so I kept carrying it around. I don't know why. I mean, I do this fairly often. I'll mark up sections and I'll open them up again, but I didn't need to be carrying it around. It just made me happy, and it made me feel like there was an answer to the uncertainty. And that was in January in particular, in which it was basically a talisman. It was a prop for whatever I was doing. It was always present.
So listeners, who wants to talk to historian Alexis Coe about her ideas that we're talking about? Maybe you read the article, or maybe some of you history buffs want to throw in with some of your own lessons for today from presidents of the past. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Since this is a school holiday, we've already been graced by a few high school English teachers when we were talking to Juno Diaz last hour. Maybe some high school history teachers want to call up. Colleges don't get the day off.
No.
So it would be a high school listener's bonanza, high school teacher's bonanza, but not college professor's bonanza today. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And the larger point you're making is that presidential biographies – don't tell you that everything is going to be okay, rather that nothing was ever okay, is the way you put it in the piece. Can you elaborate on that?
I mean, I look around and I constantly see reverberations of the past. Misattributed to Mark Twain is this quote that, you know, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it rhymes. And I think that's true. So even when I think about fake news, right, I think about Thomas Jefferson during his presidential election. The fake news published then was that he was dead. So that was quite significant. So I think, yeah, I see it. I see it everywhere.
Wait, you're not the only one to notice that this weekend.
Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, and Abraham Lincoln, and many of our greatest presidents fought with the media and called them out oftentimes on their lies.
True enough.
It's true, but they also thought they were integral to the fabric of our democracy.
Did Lincoln have major battles with the press?
Sure. He was fighting a war. He absolutely did. I think James K. Polk, any wartime president is going to disagree with the press, any president at any time, but they try to reach across the aisle. I think one of the most significant actually autobiographies, I guess you would call it, a collection of letters that I've read of late that have been particularly helpful to me is the collection of H.W. Bush's letters, in which he's unhappy with the press and he's writing. He's a prolific letter writer, and he's writing to the press. He's writing to John Lewis. He's writing to Geraldine Ferraro, who he will run against as vice president, the first woman on a major party ticket, but constantly reaching across the aisle and saying, I know that we don't agree with each other, but it doesn't mean that I'm questioning your moral character. And I think that's a really significant point that's been lost.
So I don't think I've ever said call in about President Chester Alan Arthur before, but Judy in Chelsea is doing that. Hi, Judy. You're on WNYC.
My call. Your guest didn't mention the other half of Arthur's history, which was that he had the seeds, perhaps you could say, of greatness in him before he became corrupt and then went on to surprise us, namely when he was young. He was a civil rights attorney. He took on a landmark civil rights case when a black woman was kicked off a streetcar because of her color, and she objected to that. And as a result of her taking her case to Chester Arthur, we desegregated public transport in New York City long before the rest of the country did. So he's a sort of bookended story.
That's absolutely true. So her name, the woman you mentioned, her name is Elizabeth Jennings. And when Chester A. Arthur was a 25-year-old newly minted lawyer in New York, he was assigned this case. And Elizabeth Jennings, as far as we know, the court records don't exist. So we don't know much about his role. We don't know his closing arguments. We just know that he won. His argument must have been incredible, but this is Rosa Parks, 100 years before.
That's just what I was thinking.
Absolutely. So she gets on the streetcar. She's going to church. She's a teacher. She's a respectable woman. She's a free woman in New York. Now, this is before the Civil War. So more than, half the country is still, they're slave states. And she refuses to get off the streetcar, which were all private in New York at the time. She puts up a big fuss. The conductor just does not want her on. And so he throws her off. He smashes her bonnet. There's she herself republished in Frederick Douglass's paper and are these accounts that she wrote of her ordeal. And a crowd forms around her. A police officer sides with the conductor. But she ends up, pursuing a legal case. And what's interesting is we have these hallmarks of the civil rights movement 100 years before. So we have civil disobedience. We have the swaying of public opinion through publication. And then we have legal action. And so it is a significant case. But after that, he does go into New York politics and he disappears for a while into the kickback system.
Ron in Pound Ridge, you're on WNYC with historian Alexis Coe. Hi, Ron.
Hi, how are you? There's another counterexample is James Buchanan, who was supposed to be the best prepared person we ever had for the presidency, with a long history of service, who was a terrible disaster, has always ranked zero to last. And he was followed by Abraham Lincoln, who was basically a nobody, a one-term congressman from Illinois, who's always ranked at the top. So you can't always tell in advance who's going to be great, who's going to be not so great. And another example is another New Yorker who was kicked upstairs into the vice presidency, who was thought to be crazy, a fellow named Theodore Roosevelt. He turned out to be pretty good as well.
Ron, thank you.
I was thinking about Theodore Roosevelt when you were talking about that. You know, I think that Taft is a great example of someone who also did not expect to be president, but everyone from his parents to his wife to Teddy Roosevelt, who literally campaigned for him, was pushing him in this direction. And he got to the presidency, and Roosevelt was his mentor, his friend, thought that he would just be a continuation of his legacy, and instead he learns that he's not at all. He's his own man. It was kind of a disaster. And Taft eventually ascends to what he wanted to do the entire time, which be a Supreme Court justice. He's our only, I don't know, I sort of have hopes for Obama that this could be a road for him. But he becomes it, and he says, you know, I hardly remember I was president. And when he explains how he even got the job, he says, you know, my plate was just right side up when the offices were falling.
My guest is Alexis Coe, historian, who is writing a biography of George Washington, has written the book Alice and Frida Forever, maybe you know it, is host of the podcast Presidents Are People Too on this President's Day, and maybe you read her New York Times piece over the weekend in the magazine about how she's finding reassurance about the future on this fraught President's Day by reading biographies of presidents from the past. By the way, I made that little quip that colleges are open today, but high schools are closed. So a few people have called in apparently to say, no, CUNY is definitely closed today. So, all right, maybe that's a mistake. I know that my son, who's in college out of state, has regular classes today. We had a Rutgers professor here earlier in the show who told me that there are classes today. So I guess different colleges are different. I didn't mean to freak anybody out if you think that you're cutting school today. So CUNY professors and anyone else from a university that's closed today, welcome to call in 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So it's like the politics of the country are frequently inflamed, like people's heads are going to explode. Mm-hmm. But then the country gets through those periods.
Yeah, I mean, and we have surprises. This election, we didn't realize that certain issues were important outside of, let's say, the coastal elites, as they're called now. I think about the presidency of James K. Polk, our 11th president. He wasn't supposed to win. It was Henry Clay's time, finally. He was supposed to be the president. But Polk ran on this platform where he kept saying, remember the Alamo. And a lot of people did. And that was a pretty terrible presidency in one sense. He was surreptitiously trading slaves through his wife from the Oval Office. He was Jackson's protege. We have another protege called Young Hickory to the Old Hickory. At the same time, though, some people would argue it was a good presidency. We, in fact, did remember the Alamo, got Texas, got California on the eve of the gold rush. It was good timing.
Darcy in Rockland County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Darcy.
Hi. I wanted to ask you a question about the book you're doing on Washington. This is actually the reverse of what you're talking about. This is kind of like regretting the past. We've all learned that he's such a great man, but yet lately there are horrible stories about how he treated his slaves. He supposedly really regretted having them, and he wanted to let them go. He had their teeth pulled so he could use them for his dentures, and he pursued a runaway slave so viciously. How are you going to address that?
That is one of the most challenging parts about writing a biography on George Washington. They have a great exhibition up right now at Mount Vernon at his historic home in Virginia that deals with this, and it's the first time that they have. First of all, at the time, it was fairly common for dentists to advertise in papers that teeth were wanted for dentures. So that was not uncommon. It was uncommon to read in Washington's ledger that he paid about a third the price of the going rate for teeth. that was certainly unpleasant. He inherited 11 slaves when he was 10, when his father passed away. And he did struggle with this idea, as it's explained, over time. He is the only founding father. Remember, Adams didn't have slaves, servants, indentured servants, but no slaves. He's the only founding father to emancipate his slaves. But then it gets so tricky, right? Because he... His slaves accounted for about half. I think it was about 150. The others were from Martha Custis's estate, so they would be inherited by her descendants. And it was also the emancipation was manumission was contingent on her death. And so there's this interesting period in the year that follows in which the slaves know this. Martha Washington intends to hold on to them. She's a big working plantation, but she gets nervous, and it's some historians have written this to be a change of heart on her part too. There's a letter from Abigail Adams to one of her sisters that says, no, she's just scared, and that's why she set them free. Now, Washington also, there's this trickery involved. When before D.C. was the home of the White House, our nation's capital, of course, everything occurred in Philadelphia at the president's house. And Washington, it never occurs to him that that's a free city, that his slaves might think that's a better option for them. And so there's a law that says every 6 months, a slave is in Philadelphia for more than 6 months, they are free. And so what he does is he actually just has Martha like go to Mount Vernon or somewhere else, travel with them, and then come back so that the clock resets, never thinking that when the clock resets that they might just walk out the front door, that when they go to the market, they'll be talking to a whole network of people. And so Oney Judge is the slave that was referred to. And she left. She had been with Martha her entire life, and Martha thought of her as what Martha deemed a daughter. But of course, we would understand not to be at all. And she was Martha was about to give her away. So she panicked, and she, as a wedding present, she panicked. She left. She got on a boat. We don't exactly know how. She went into New Hampshire. And as was the custom of the time, because you have to remember that this is not an excuse, but this was considered property. And so he put an advertisement in many papers to pursue her, to bring her back, and was thankfully unsuccessful.
Wow. You know a lot about that. Is that going to be a main focus of your Washington biography?
No, that story has grown. It's become quite popular because there was a Drunk History episode about it. And so I'm asked constantly about Oney Judge.
And his relationship with slavery doesn't seem to stop Washington from consistently being ranked our best or second best behind Lincoln president. Did you see, or maybe you even got a vote as a historian, I don't know, that the latest C-SPAN list of best presidents, which just came out, Lincoln's number one as usual, Washington's number two as usual?
I did. Some of it seemed, frankly, a bit bonkers, and then some of it seemed great. But the thing is with Washington is we would rather remember that he had wooden teeth, which is a totally implausible story. They would get wet. They would crumble. His breath would have been legendary. We would rather believe that than circulate the story of slave teeth. And the same thing with kneeling at Valley Forge. The progenitor of these apocryphal stories was this guy named Parson Weems, who just happened to be at the right place at the right time, an itinerant minister looking to make a quick buck on a biography. And he made all these stories up, and even at the time they were called out, but yet they're continually taught in schools today.
You know your friend Chester Allen Arthur is ninth from the bottom on that C-SPAN.
I know. That seems fair.
What's the bonkers part?
I think putting James K. Polk up there is – I think he's 14th maybe on this one.
Yes. In fact, I'll give listeners a little stretch, because President Obama debuted – high on the list of 44 past presidents, number 12.
Which is difficult to even assess at this point. I mean, you can say things like, yes, financial recovery, we already know that's true, but policies take decades. And it's so hard to judge one president without the bookends, as we can definitely see right now. So that seemed a bit presumptuous to me.
So a little context, number 12 for Obama was just below Reagan, LBJ, and Woodrow Wilson, who were 9, 10, and 11. And Obama at number 12 was just ahead of Monroe, Polk, and Bill Clinton, who's then followed by McKinley, Madison, Andrew Jackson, and John Adams. Is there a presentism bias up in that high echelon? I mean, there's like all the presidents of, you know, people alive today's lifetime, it seems like. Reagan, LBJ, Clinton, and Obama, all ranking higher than, you know, founding fathers like John Adams and,
well,
and James Madison.
That doesn't surprise me. John Adams just these presidents are not fashionable anymore. A documentary producer recently contacted me and said, you know, I can't find anyone under 60 who wants to talk about the founding fathers. And I understand that. People are coming at history from a gendered perspective. I'm a presidential historian. I'm also a women's historian. So I understand that. Slavery. These are the topics that people want to cover. And so I think that has something to do with it. On college campuses today, we know that there's a backlash against people like Wilson, against Jefferson. And so that makes sense. That's maybe the presentism that you're hitting upon. I think that we see the effectiveness of some of these policies right now from those presidents. And so that's very much at the forefront of people's minds. But Lincoln is always going to be number one. He saved the Union, and Washington is always going to be number two because he founded it.
Alexis Coe, author of Alice and Frida Forever, and she's writing a biography of George Washington. If you want to hear more of her, because this was really good, so you probably want to hear more of her, and she has a podcast called Presidents Are People Too. How often do you do it?
It comes out every 2 weeks. I co-host it with a comedian named Elliot Kalin, who used to be the head writer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and we're old friends. This was born out of the things we like to do at parties to be cool, which is go in a corner and talk about presidential history. We cover all the presidents, and it's been great. I mean, I went to Jimmy Carter's Sunday school class in Georgia. He asked me, what's a podcast?
It was,
and so I get to look at these guys. And in his Sunday school class, I had this like non-religious moment about him, which was that he was almost too good of a person to be a president. And that in his very long forced retirement that has occurred since was maybe the best thing for the country, and maybe couldn't have happened had he not had this very challenging presidency. I mean, he's eradicated guinea worms from countries. He's made major contributions that perhaps we can be more thankful for than the presidency itself.
Alexis Coe, happy President's Day.
Thank you. Thanks,
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. More to come. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live from the Green Space. We thank our studio audience, people who have come down to see the show live in the Green Space this morning. We thank the Jerome L. Green Foundation, as always. And you heard the Indivisible promo during that break. Tonight, I'll be hosting our national call-in show, Indivisible, at 8 o'clock with a President's Week special, the first month of the Trump administration, through the eyes of presidential historian Douglas Brinkley and NPR's Cokie Roberts and callers from around the country. So join me tonight at 8. Right now, we are so lucky that our Green Space show coincidentally comes during President's Week because we were able to invite a group of teachers down here to talk broadly about education, something we like to do on school holidays. And in the context of today's news, education at the dawn of the Betsy DeVos era. We also have, as my partner for this segment, NPR's lead education blogger, lead digital education correspondent, Anya Kamenetz, author of several books, including Generation Debt, DIYU, EduPucks, Edupreneurs, and the Coming Transformation of Higher Education, and most recently, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, But You Don't Have to Be. Hi, Anya. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Brian.
And with us here at the Green Space, sitting in the front row, hybrid audience members and guests, are Patrick James Walsh, an ESL teacher at Sojourner Truth School. That's PSMS 149, a K-8 public school in Harlem. Patrick has been at Sojourner for 13 years. He's also his school's union rep. Ariel Sachs, who teaches 8th grade English at the Renaissance Charter School, which is a pre-K through 12 public charter school in Jackson Heights. She's been a teacher for 13 years and has been at Renaissance for the past three. And she tells us the school serves a large special ed population as well as many immigrants and English language learners. Annalise Silivanch teaches English and debate to 10th through 12th graders at Abraham Clark High School in Roselle, New Jersey, and she has a child herself at a charter school in Morristown. Sante Mastriana teaches 9th and 10th grade ESL and global history and is the testing coordinator for the Bronx Latin School, which serves 6th through 12th graders in the Bronx. This is third year I see at Bronx Latin. Candace Simon teaches 6th grade at Brooklyn Collaborative, which is a New York City Outward Bound 6th through 12th school in Carroll Gardens. Her 10th year teaching at the school began in 2001 in education through the New York City Teaching Fellows Program. And Marissa Crone, special ed teacher at PS 23, a K through 5 elementary school in is it 23 or is it 234? 234. Somebody left out the 4 on my script, but I know that school. This school has 750 students across grade levels with about 20% special ed students, and she has taught there for 7 years. So great to have all of you here. Thank you very much for spending part of your school holiday with us. Should we just go down the row here and, you know, call the roll a little bit? Patrick, what's the best and worst part of your job?
The best part of my job is dealing with immigrant children who are lovely. The worst part of my job is dealing with the bureaucracy.
Ariel, want to take a crack at that?
Sure. The best part of my job is definitely working with the students, and just being a part of their lives and also, figuring out how to empower them. And the worst part of my job, I think, is just the kind of the rigidity of the way that the role and the career of a teacher is laid out. I think, you know, we're part of a long-term struggle to become a true profession, and right now it's just still a little bit too rigid and standardized the way that our work life is set up.
Give the mic back to Patrick for a second, and I want to ask you what part of the bureaucracy you were thinking of as most getting in your way as a teacher.
Well, we have been totally stripped of autonomy as teachers, which is one of the reasons we have been largely stripped of creativity. We have been, how can I put this, to a great extent shackled to the place where I was asked by a dear friend of mine whose child was thinking about going into education, that should she do it? And sadly, I had to say no.
So. Sante, best and worst parts of your job?
Hands down, the best part of my job is working with the students. I won't say it's the worst part. The hardest part of my job is also working with the students. But the worst part of my job is, unfortunately, despite the fact...
We could tell that he teaches 10th through 12th grade.
Yeah.
Though might have guessed middle school, but go ahead.
Despite the fact that my school as a public school is succeeding in ways that many other in New York City are not, the worst part of the job is experiencing firsthand the extent to which the public education system, whether implemented through charter schools or public schools, anyone would acknowledge, is objectively not meeting the needs of modern society. And experiencing that firsthand and seeing how...
What does that mean?
Well, we have a lot of policies in place, both officially and just kind of in our culture, that, well, you know, everyone needs to go to college and we need to do all these, you know, academics and all of it. But it's still rooted in this idea that, well, if you go to college, you get a job. And that's simply not true anymore. And would I ever suggest that my students shouldn't go to college? Absolutely not. Absolutely. If they can make something of themselves, they should. But we are circumscribing their prospects in a way that is not meeting the demands of what the world is really like.
Annalise, your turn. Best and worst.
Well, the best part of my job is also the students. I teach 3 sections of debate every day, and they are curious and complex. They're at a turning point in their lives. One of my students got a $20,000 scholarship to the new school, and it's a Title I school, so it's very exciting. I love asking them what they want to learn about next, because our list is very long for the rest of the year. The worst part of my job, well, the state was in our school all day on Friday, and boy, we were exhausted.
What were they doing?
Just a regular check, sort of visiting classrooms, and the goals are really noble and helpful, but I had a student say to me, "Miss, they were hanging over me in class," and you know, just it's a different feel in the school for the day. And well, I wouldn't say that's the worst part of my job. You know, maybe it's the late nights grading, but you know, certainly it's part of what we're dealing with.
Candace, yeah. How about you?
The best part of my job is the students as well, and being privileged to teach in a school that is not focused on the test and where teachers get to write a lot of their own curriculum and looking for culturally relevant topics to teach and preparing students to be civic minded and being geared towards social justice. And the worst part of my job is probably teaching pubescent middle schoolers.
Marissa?
Not to be repetitive, but to echo everyone else, the best part is the students. I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't laugh at something a student has said or just find some enjoyment in spending time with them. And then the worst part, I would echo the bureaucracy, but from a separate part outside of, I think I'm privileged to be in a school that grants me a lot of autonomy and creativity and being able to do what I need to do. But I would say that there is that kind of icky paperwork piece of it that I think as a profession we're not really granted the respect of time and space to do that and to get it done in a way that feels comprehensive and thoughtful.
So Anya Kamenetz, NPR education reporter, I think on the worst part side, down the row, we heard a limit to their autonomy, a limit to their ability to teach without the bureaucracy getting in the way of everything and micromanaging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, my book, The Test, really delved into the history of how we got here, where over the last 15 or 16, now 20 years of education policy, there's been this accountability culture that's come in to say, and what underlies that, I think, is a culture of not trusting teachers as much, right? Why do we need all of these checks? Why do we need standardized tests for every grade? Because people don't trust teachers, they don't empower teachers, they don't train teachers, they don't give them the ability to actually get out there and teach, which is what the best performing school systems in the world do.
But if we look at it from a 15-year sweep of policy, which is the time frame that you just kind of laid out, you know, we had George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind, which tried to establish accountability school by school, including the success at closing race and income disparities within the school.
Right.
Obama's Race to the Top aimed for a different kind of accountability with the standardized test results, counting for more. 15 years later, has the government accomplished anything, in your view, as a reporter who's been studying this, even if the teachers don't like it, in closing educational disparities?
I think most people will say that it's a good thing that we're talking about, you know, achievement gaps and reporting out the performance of different groups that might have been swept under the rug before. On the negative side, we have our minds around the problem. But on the negative side, you know, just as the door was shutting, the Obama administration's Department of Ed put out a report saying our school improvement grant program, that $3 billion program, the biggest education grant program ever created under Race to the Top, had null results. There were no results, positive results in school turnaround, in school closure. So we really are at a blank slate moment, which is so fascinating because we're making such a hairpin turn in policy and kind of saying that none of that stuff really did very much. I mean, there are certainly changes around the edges. No one would say that there's no progress, but.
What's the Betsy DeVos hairpin turn? Is it vouchers primarily, which is what's been in the news?
I think what's extreme about DeVos and her record is really a culture of, you know, not just lamenting the problems of failing public schools, but really saying there's no use in public schools, that we're going to, as much as we can, leave those behind and create either charter schools that are for-profit, that have relatively little accountability. She, you know, she was very clear, and she's repeated it since in her confirmation hearings and to the press, that she doesn't think that all schools that receive federal money should be held to the same accountability standards. And so she's praised programs such as in Florida, where state money goes to schools that are not subject to the same rules. So it really is privatization. I think that's the word that best fits it.
I think we have a clip of her from her confirmation hearings with Senator Maggie Hassan to this exact point.
Individual with Disabilities in Education Act. That's a federal civil rights law. So do you stand by your statement a few minutes ago that it should be up to the states whether to follow it?
The law must be followed. Federal law must be followed where federal dollars are in play.
So were you unaware when I just asked you about the IDEA that it was a federal law?
I may have confused it.
Marissa, you're a special ed teacher here.
Yes. Yes.
What does she need to go to school on?
So many things. I think that was alarming. And I think, like I said, as much as the paperwork can be what we call like the paperwork can be burdensome, I know that in reality it serves a greater purpose to make sure that I'm doing my job in a way that feels appropriate and well-serving to the students that I'm serving. So I think to hear someone so thoughtlessly disregard that the fact a law even exists to allow inclusion and mandate inclusion is really concerning from the perspective as a special ed professional, but also from the perspective as an educator that believes in intellectual curiosity and research.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back with our six teachers, let's do a little thought experiment. What if we went to a complete voucher system in the United States? What if all the families could get the same amount of money that the combination of local, state, and federal government is spending on them at your public schools, and schools would have to compete for their dollars? We're going to get these six teachers' point of view on that. Imagine that alternative future. And Anya Kamenetz from NPR. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer live from the Green Space on WNYC. WNYC live from the Green Space today with our panel of six public school teachers from around the New York area, and that includes district schools and charter schools from schools in New York and New Jersey. I'm not going to go through everybody's specific IDs again, or it would take the rest of our time, but also with us Anya Kamenetz, the lead digital education reporter for NPR. By the way, Anya, you came in saying that there's a little breaking education news today having to do with transgender kids policy.
This hasn't been completely confirmed, I'm going to say that, but we have seen that. So the Obama administration took steps last year to expand transgender student rights under Title IX. It's being reported that the Trump administration may be rolling that back. Attorney General Sessions has already taken steps to stay the order, the case that had been pursued by his predecessor. So that's something that we're watching.
So teachers, as a thought experiment, what if we had a total voucher system? Assume for the moment the best possible voucher system. All the money spent per pupil today goes to that family to spend on a school. Schools are private and compete for those vouchers. You would still be employable as teachers, presumably. Would that give us better or worse urban education for poor kids, which is who most of you teach, than we have today? Who wants it? Yeah, go ahead.
I'll take it. I think if you want a window into what a universally voucher system, which Michigan is not, but it is one of the closest examples we have,
DeVos.
So being outside of Michigan, it's hard to understand how much influence and power the DeVos family really has. But if you actually look into their record, I went through an article by Kate Czernicki at the New York Times. It was published last year in June. She kind of broke down all of the problems that Michigan has experienced as a direct result of DeVos's influence, which is expanding school vouchers, deregulating charter schools, to the point that Michigan's charter schools are now 80% for-profit companies. This means that they have a direct profit motive to recruit students, and they operate in the same way. They have these things called count day competitions, where it's, well, if you come to our school, your kid gets a laptop and an iPod. And it's like, it reminds me of those when we were in school and they would make us sell like the candies or whatever, so you would win the little prizes and really it was nothing.
Able to compete because they want to make money, and Candace, I'll let you in to answer this follow-up question. These for-profit schools want to you know, make some money, and therefore they're going to have to prove to their customers that they're the best at what they do, and they're going to give you the laptops, and, oh, we have these test scores or whatever else they want to advertise. Why wouldn't that be good?
I think what's scary for me about the vouchers is that it, even if all families got the same amount of money, schools cost, these private schools will have their own tuition, and some families that are more wealthy will be able to send their kids to those schools with the voucher or pay in excess of what the voucher allows, and the families that are poor will not be able to pay that. That's
exactly the argument that they use for a voucher system now, because the families without money are relegated to usually the neighborhood public schools, which might be terrible.
Right, and maybe there won't be any neighborhood private schools, and families won't be able to get their kids to those private schools that are better. So I just think fundamentally it's really problematic and will create the kind of segregation that we fought long ago to not have.
You wanted in on this?
Yeah, I think this would be a nightmare. I am a believer in public life, in public works, and in the public good. We are not made to rip each other's throats out from kindergarten to the grave. I have seen this kind of thing in the charter wars in Harlem. It is ugly. It is brutal. It destroys neighborhoods. It destroys friendships. And it improves nothing, excepting the bank accounts of hedge funders and whoever else, whatever edupreneurs are on the grab.
Arielle, you teach at a charter school, right?
I do. I mean, we're different than some other charter schools because we're a hub of the community. We started out as a district school and voted 5 years in to become charter school. So that was like 20 years ago. I may not have the year exact. And we remained in the UFT, so we're a unionized faculty. So I think the problem that I see with going to vouchers would be kind of resegregation, or really a further segregation. We have a problem with segregated schools here in New York City now because we do have a fair amount of school choice built into our system. And so, you know, through charters and also through just the ability to go to a school that's not your neighborhood school. So we have people sorting themselves.
Then of your school as a charter school?
I would say I've taught in both public schools and charter schools. And I mean, I think we have a bit more flexibility than some public schools when it comes to curriculum, how we use our funds, how we evaluate teachers. But it is like a constant negotiation with the state rather than with the city. So that's a difference. So I would say, though, in a lot of ways, when it comes to schools, it's who's in charge, really.
And Annalise, you teach.
So it's not that different.
At a regular public school in Roselle, New Jersey, but you have a child at a charter school in Morristown. Do you have a basis for comparison then through your two experiences?
I do. And by the way, New Jersey does not allow for-profit charters. So we are strictly nonprofit and publicly owned charters. And I think that's the perfect middle ground for me, because I think, as Ariel is saying, it's a charter school that can be flexible. Unity Charter has been operating for 18 years. It's one of the oldest. And because it's small, it's only 234 kids. The flexibility around the charter and things that they can try, they do democratic governance, they do positive discipline. It's, you know, it's like a dream school. But it's a public lottery. It's accessible. And so I think we need schools like that to show other schools where the problems are in public education. Like, for instance, I really think that public schools have a values problem, right? We teach kids to protect the environment, and then we send them down the hall to go use disposable everything in the cafeteria. So I think we need little schools like Unity to be laboratories to show how it can be done and if it can be done.
We just have about 30 seconds left in the program. Anya Kamenetz, what's the debate to come? Is it going to be, you know, the Republican Congress and Trump and DeVos putting through some kind of massive federal voucher system? Or what are the real political parameters of this? Can you tell?
I think the fascinating point that we're at right now is that the people in charge at the federal level don't want federal authority. And so the reauthorization of the, I mean, I know that sounds strange, but the reauthorization of Every Student Succeeds Act was about giving more power to the states and more power to localities. And now they're moving even farther in that direction. So honestly, I think it's going to be way up to our teachers and the local level of education. We're going to see exactly how powerful that can be.
Anya Kamenetz, lead education blogger for NPR. And thanks to the six of you who came from schools all over the area. Thank you so, so much. Thanks to our entire great audience here at the Green Space. Thanks, everybody, for coming. And thanks, everybody, listening for listening. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Talk to you tonight at 8 on Indivisible. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or Facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.